Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I am your host, Shelley Wade, and today we are talking about engaging in civil discourse. Whether you're in Anchorage or in Alaska, how do we talk about Alaska's important issues? Is it possible to have civil conversations about potentially polarizing and even sometimes highly emotional issues? My guests and in the studio today are Steve Johnson, and Steve is the Associate Professor and Director of Debate at UAA. Libby Roderick, who is the Associate Director at the UAA Center for Advancing Faculty Excellence, and Nils Andreessen, who's the Executive Director for the Institute of the North. Thank you all for being here today. So we, for listeners that are out there today, we really want to hear from you. So we would love to take your calls and your emails. So please email or call us your comments, questions, or ideas about how you or how we as South Central residents or even broader as Alaskans can communicate on important issues. So you can call us in Anchorage at 550-8433 or outside of Anchorage at 1-888-353-5752. And we also have a few interesting links online, so you can check us out at alaskapublic.org. There are a few things, links to things like the University of Alaska Anchorage Seawolf debate team. Also, the Institute of the North has a couple of resources online. We also have links to the University of Arizona and Kansas State University. Their civil discourse links, some interesting resources for you there. So to kick us off today, we really wanted to start out by just getting kind of a broader understanding or better understanding of what do we mean by civil discourse? So how do we define that? And really, how would you recognize it if you heard it or if you saw it? And what are the key elements? So Steve, I think we'll start with you and get your thoughts on how would you define that as the debate team director of UAA? How do you define that?
Well, I guess I would say the fundamental element of civil discourse in my book would be open-mindedness. And a willingness to appreciate differing perspectives and different points of view. And I think that's one of the things that we've seen deteriorate of late is people's willingness to contemplate the possibility that they might not know everything, that they might not have all of the answers, or that their perspective might not be infallible. So when I'm teaching my debaters, one of the stories that I regularly tell them is the moment in my career where I came to understand that the value of debating lie not so much in its ability to train people to be advocates, which, although useful and an important skill, didn't seem to me to be the ultimate goal of what it was I was doing. There came a moment when I realized that the power of debate and teaching debating lies in its ability, I think, to erase people's conviction, at least to the extent that they're open to the possibility that they're wrong. And I think one of the great things about debate as I teach it and debate as we practice it in competition and try to engage it in our community service projects is to really give people the opportunity to argue both sides of an issue or to be responsible for arguing and understanding both sides of the issue. There's a competitive motivation, obviously, for doing that. The more you know about the other side's arguments, the more prepared you are to answer those arguments and engage them. And I think in that process, whether it happens explicitly or it happens perhaps unwittingly by the participants, there comes a point when they start to realize by coming to understand the other side's perspective, you begin to recognize that that perspective has validity and has merit and is worth your consideration. And I think that that's been the most powerful lesson that I've been able to convey through academic debating.
So, Libby, anything that you would add to that definition?
No, I think that's exactly right. The first word that came to my mind was respect. Mm-hmm. And in regards to your question about what does it look like, can you recognize it when you see it, I'm fortunate to be in the midst of those kinds of things a lot. I just in the last couple of weeks was part of a discussion about Pebble Mine in which people who violently oppose each other's position treated each other with great respect, conceded points that were in fact unknown or unknowable or areas of weakness in their own positions to each other, wished each other well, if not success, at their own particular agenda, and actually were able to discuss the facts at hand without people, throwing insults or other objects. I was also present in a university setting where we discussed gun control. And similarly, overwhelmingly, the people in the room were for gun control. And I put them through a process where they seriously needed to entertain another perspective. And you could palpably watch the respect in the room shift. It went from an attitude where the people that they disagreed with were clearly, it wasn't said, but it was vibed, weren't as smart, mm-hmm. in the worst case, you know, were missing a couple of pieces, into realizing actually that they were missing a couple of pieces. And that there, as you said, they may not agree with one another, but there is a legitimate perspective on both sides. There are legitimate needs that might not be being met on both sides. There are legitimate interests at stake on both sides. And just one more example, I was involved in a discussion here in Alaska a while back, excuse me, about illegal drug use. And the same thing happened in about a 15-minute period. People who clearly held extremely hostile and judgmental views about people with the other position, there was this palpable energetic shift in the room so that the dialogue could continue. People often don't change their minds, but what changes is the tone of the relationship. And in terms of a democracy, in terms of actually the future of any group of people working together towards anything of mutual good, that tone is huge. If people aren't respected, they're out. Nobody does well with disrespect. Nobody. So if you can regain that, you've gained a lot.
Anything that you would add, Neil, so from the perspective of someone that's really engaged in kind of broader statewide topics too right now, anything that jumps out at you that to add to what Steve and Libby have said in terms of, I heard things like respect and open-mindedness and kind of shifting in tone, a lot of great stuff. Other elements that you recognize as civil discourse?
Yeah, I think when it comes to civil discourse, you have to be motivated, intentional, and creative. You have to recognize that there's value in being civil. And, you know, that's, as Libby was, you know, describing respect, it was something that, you know, was made me fearful, is that what if people don't value that? If you can't overcome someone's interests, or someone's not, you know, motivated, which is kind of the second term, to value other people's perspectives, and to want to change, shift, think new things, then, you know, that's a scary prospect that somebody wouldn't want that. So being motivated, wanting to see civility in the civic sphere, in the community, I think intentional is all about how you use words, and it goes back to respect, and it's being purposeful in how you communicate and what you talk about, and really being, I think some of it's respect and some of it's just recognizing that, there's a trust element, I guess. Mm-hmm. We're all in this together. We're human. There's love and there's caring and there's all those generous aspects that you have to be thoughtful of. And then finally, I think you have to be creative, because sometimes the choices are so stark, or the us versus them perspective is so clearly delineated that you have to be imaginative in how you approach a different future. And so creatively coming up with solutions, with problem solving, with putting various pieces aside to come up with some middle ground, is really important. So I guess that's what comes to my mind.
And the thing I thought that was interesting that you said, Libby, is it's not, you're not necessarily going to change someone's mind, but you're going to change the tone of the conversation and improve the dialogue that way and change the form, make it a safe environment to share those different thoughts. So we have a listener on the line. Jay, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Hi. Oh, my name's SJ, I think, if you're talking to me.
Yes.
Oh, hi. Yes, I'm calling. I'm president of the Fairview Community Council, and I actually first got involved in our community council in the debate over Carlick Manor, the Housing First project that's in our neighborhood. And I guess the kind of listening to your commentators, it's really interesting. Rural Cap and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, who are the two parties that were involved in Carlick Manor, they're really good at what they do. And, you know, I mean, they care so much about their clients, and they're willing to kind of do whatever it takes to sort of accomplish their goals with their client base, which is really admirable. But of course, with in the issue of Carlick Manor, sort of the neighborhood didn't feel that we were considered a stakeholder in the dialogue and planning. And so we found ourselves really having to take an adversarial role. And really it's a matter of kind of the tone and the way that the interaction started and kind of continued through the whole thing. And frankly, I mean, I think by being adversarial, the project is more successful than it would have been if we weren't involved in the project. But at the same time, there's still no trust the relationship between the community and those two organizations is still lacking trust, which is kind of an unfortunate side of the way that kind of other approach goes.
So I guess if I'm understanding you correctly, SJ, that you're saying that you would have liked the opportunity to have a civil discourse, and so there seems like there would have been a chance to kind of build that, and maybe there still is this opportunity to continue that dialogue with.
I mean, we're always open to talking. I guess, there are kind of requirements in the public process that can be, for lack of a better word, can be real or can be more pro forma. And the community definitely felt that kind of the public hearings and the kind of the reach out to the community that was done was really more pro forma. It's like, this is what we're doing, and, you're welcome to comment on it or something like that, as opposed to sort of really asking what the goals of the neighborhood are, what we feel the problems are, what issues we see with kind of their plans, and really being considered a stakeholder from the start. I think the whole dialogue would have went a lot more differently and, frankly, to the benefit of their clients. So,
Thank you. Thank you so much for your comments and for your call, SJ. So, Libby, I saw you kind of nodding your head while SJ was talking. Any specific thoughts or feedback that you have?
I was partially nodding because I'm aware of this particular situation. And I think you bring up just an amazingly important piece, which is that in the difficult dialogues work that I have done, if I had to say that there's a central need to make sure that our dialogues are productive, it is that people feel and are heard. And that's what I think partly I meant about respect, is that there are very real needs, whether we agree with them always or not. And if people are not heard, then you are left with situations just like he's articulating, where there is mistrust, there is a backlash. Sometimes it can go on for generations, right? This need to include everybody, this need to, right from the beginning, ensure that one group of people is not making the call of who that everybody is. And it brings to mind, at UAA, we've done a bunch of work with Indigenous ways of teaching and learning and difficult dialogues. And some of the processes that come from our Alaska Native cultures of 10,000 years of needing to make sure that their communities were intact and healthy and could move forward together are brilliant. And that is one of their primary teachings, is that every single voice is important. Every single perspective must be heard. That's often why they teach consensus and will take as long as it takes to ensure that people can live with a solution, rather than what we often do, which is what he said, which is we move forward too quickly, or we move forward partially without including everybody, or we override groups of people because the majority outvotes the minority, but lo and behold, the minority will come back and get you later because they feel unheard. So that element of respect is partly what I heard him talking about. It's one of the central errors we make over and over again and then pay for over time.
So we have another caller online. Bill, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Well, thank you. My name is Bill Hall. I'm with Alaska Common Ground. We've been working with the libraries across the state and in Anchorage to create a program called Let's Talk Alaska. And in Anchorage with the Lusac Library, we've been working on Let's Talk Anchorage. I would just say that there's a distinction that we make when we try to plan and design a dialogue, that there's a difference between dialogue, deliberation, and debate. They're not all the same. Dialogue is usually often about creating relationships and building trust and sharing. The deliberation is often about choice making, making factually informed choice making, and then debate is usually associated with being with argument. So I think there's a difference in as you consider these things and talk about it, to understand that there's a difference these aren't synonymous terms. And one of the key things, and I'll finish with this, is that one of the key things in the work that we've been doing is it's not about talking, it's usually about listening, and people don't know how to listen. And one of the best definitions I've heard of listening is to create space within yourself, an emptiness, a suspended judgment, for the other person to tell you who they are. So with that, I'll just say thank you very much. This is a great topic. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much, Bill. Appreciate your call and your thoughts. So I wonder, Steve, if you could talk a little bit about Bill's point of the distinction between dialogue and debate. So I did have here in my notes, because maybe I'm not quite understanding it completely, that you know part of the dialogue or the civil discourse that happens can be defined by debate. And within debate, I took my little notes that have like the breakdown of what it is, the difference between an opinion and an argument within that context. So can you share a little bit and help us understand a little bit better, you know, what is the difference? Is there a difference? And is one method better than the other?
I don't think you can say generally that one method is better than the other. I think there are contexts in which these different options are more and less appropriate. So the debate with which I'm obviously most familiar is competitive academic debate. And that is often, I shouldn't say often, it's sometimes perceived by people as something that perhaps we shouldn't be teaching, because they identify debate as this incredibly polarizing, zero-sum, win-at-all-costs kind of approach to working through problems. And certainly, like any tool, it can be abused. And there are certainly examples that we can look at in our public discourse where people perhaps did not engage in the process of debating a topic in ways that were noble or ethical or productive. But I don't think that that is a comment on the tool so much as it is a comment on the ends sought by the person using that tool. So I guess the purist in me wants to react and say, no, debate's not bad. It's all about how you use it. But at the same time, I can acknowledge that it does structure itself in such a way that it does lend to this distributive model of conflict resolution. One side gets everything when they win, and the other side gets nothing when they lose. And if that is what most people understand debate to be, then I can see the concern that they might have for it. I think at its best, debate is like dialogue, and debate is like discussion, insofar as it attempts to elucidate different perspectives and offer opportunities for those representatives from those different perspectives to voice their interests, to give their perspective on the circumstances at hand. And so if done well, it can be a very powerful and useful tool. And I can talk more about how it's a powerful and useful tool, primarily because I think it gives a safe space in which to explore those ideas. Again, coming at it from the academic perspective, one of the things that we try and teach students is that they have the opportunity to give voice to these arguments, to these positions, and to these opinions. And when creating for them a safe space to do so, when saying to them, you get to advocate for this position, it may not be the position that you personally hold as your own convictions, but it's a very powerful intellectual exercise to explore the arguments for that position in an effort to get to understand them better. And as I mentioned earlier, in doing so, you quite often get to understand the other perspective better as well.
That's the thing that I thought when I was doing my research that was the most interesting or kind of engaging in that piece and the description of debate was, you know, this difference between opinion and argument. And when you break down argument, you have these three pieces of assertion, reasoning, and evidence. And I liked the idea a lot of thinking through, you know, kind of what's the tagline of your argument, you know, what's the reason that you got there? And then what's your evidence? I guess that's always the piece that maybe many of us feel like are missing from some of our dialogues between our civic leaders and others, that we're craving some of that evidence. So if you are just tuning in, you're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Shelley Wade, and today we are talking about engaging in civil discourse. So whether you're an Anchorage resident or outside of Anchorage or an Alaskan, you know, is it really possible for us to have civil conversations about tough topics? If you have a comment or question, we would really like to hear from you. In Anchorage, you can call us at 550-8433 or outside of Anchorage at 1-888-353-5752. So with the comment on evidence, I'm wondering, what do you folks feel like are really what is the role of facts and education in finding solutions on contentious issues. So I think a lot of us hear a topic, something like the topics that I listed in the promo for this show today were, you know, Title 21, equal rights for gay people, housing for the homeless. Immediately, we feel some guttural emotional responses, but there's a whole bunch of facts and figures and some education and history behind each of these topics. You know, how do we really get people to think about the facts or the education? So, Nils, do you have any thoughts on that?
No. So something I was thinking about from actually the last two callers and from Steve's comments, it's all about what you want to achieve. And the methods that you use are connected to the outcomes. And so you heard SJ talk about having to be adversarial to get their point across, which might not be part of civil discourse, but is part of the civic sphere. I think when we talk about indigenous ways of communicating and facilitating, the outcome is community cohesion and ways forward that leaves everyone intact. And when it comes to debate, this kind of zero-sum game that's developed. So, I mean, really being conscious of how what you're doing can achieve different goals, and how you use fact, how you use different arguments is, I guess, you know, the best example for me is, you know, listening for, you know, yellow flags or bells that go off in my head when somebody's making attribution that doesn't make sense, or there's causality versus attribution, and just all kinds of different, things that people aren't really careful of in articulating a position, that you know it doesn't ring true. So that's when Alaskans, I think, can have an opportunity to say, well, maybe that's not quite right, and call people on it. Throw that yellow flag in the community sphere.
Mm-hmm. So Libby, you said you're just starting to engage in the your first difficult dialogues class and really fleshing that out, and the topic is not an easy one, and that's Pebble Mind. So how about this education, the role of facts in education in what you're doing, and are you trying to walk away from that experience with some potential solutions, or really what are the desired outcomes for that process?
The course itself is about talking about contentious natural resource issues using Pebble Mind as a case study for the Pebble Project. So we won't be necessarily coming up with solutions, but we're hoping the students walk away with an understanding of both the complexities of these kinds of issues, but also methodologies to begin to approach them. And the question of facts and evidence is huge these days, as we all know. I'm thinking, I can't remember who said it, but there is a statement, you are entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts. And so I think one of the roles of what Steve tries to do in higher education is about, of course, is developing critical thinking skills, insisting that people, when they make arguments, they do base them in evidence. That is an argument. However, what I'm also, there's so many thoughts going on in my mind right now, right? I mean, one of the things we're trying to get to is a society in which we can actually perceive the facts and agree upon those facts, so we find some middle ground that is separate from the incredibly polarized advertising that goes on, the Fox News style of discussion, the political things that go on, and, you know, when someone's trying to persuade you to vote for somebody against somebody else, that intense adversarial field in which we're operating, many people yearn for just a chance to, could we just talk about the evidence without it becoming, you know, the Middle East, basically. And where I go with that partly is, and with Pebble, it's very clear because almost everyone has a gut reaction to that issue in Alaska. And there has been some research done lately, and it's also been criticized, but there is a book out called The Righteous Mind, and many people know about it, in which there are some claims made, and I'm not sure how valid they are, but that in essence, we start with that gut reaction and our arguments follow, that no one is really starting with the evidence and then coming up with their gut feelings and opinions. We're actually almost always operating from those gut levels and then making up reasons why you should take them to be true. So what I do with that and in difficult dialogues work is acknowledge that we are emotional creatures, not just intellectual creatures. I can sit there and you can talk to me all day about something I disagree with you on, and I will acknowledge your points, perhaps even, and I will go home and probably think exactly what I thought before. That does seem to be true for many people. We do change our minds sometimes, but it takes a lot more than a couple of good arguments. And I think that's really where these things become so important in terms of honoring people. That's where you work with people on their stories, for example. Why? Why do you hold this position? What is your storyline? Who are your ancestors? How did you arrive at this position? What's at stake here, right? And some of the processes that are used, not just in public policy discussions and civic discourse, but also in personal, private ones, you know, things like nonviolent communication, where they take the positions people find themselves in and find take them through the process of dropping into the needs underneath them. What is the need that must be met here? What is your greatest fear if your adversaries win, right? What's at stake? Or what are your interests here? You know, somebody gave me an example of a parent who'd been with a child, you know, in an argument for a long time about their curfew, right? And when they finally dropped into what's the interest here? The parent, of course, their interest was the safety of the child. You know, the child's interest was having a little autonomy, and they worked out an issue that had been a source of pain for years with just some little check-in point where the parent could get their need met and the child could get their need met, and, you know, peace then ensued. So there's a lot of things here, but that question of evidence is so critical, public policy, but the emotional nature of the human being requires us to go a bit deeper.
Go ahead, Nels.
I mean, does evidence, it can be used by both sides, right? The same set of figures can be used to support one argument that is the exact opposite of the other. And it seems like, and I loved your description, Libby, of how, I mean, you have to get to values and fears and interests and all those other pieces that actually make up relationships, or lack thereof, I guess. You know, some of it for me is the who is at the table question. You know, in Canada, they've got a great public policy process of consultation with a big C, where the governments are required to involve Native communities, the Aboriginal communities. And it works because everybody's at the table. And so I think there's a saying, no decision about us without us. And like, if you can just get to something like that, then you're at least, you know, it seems like you're a step in the right direction and able to address some of those relationship pieces that are at the heart of it, whether facts are involved or no matter how facts are involved.
Mm-hmm. And let me just throw in while I can. At First Alaskans Institute got a major grant from Kellogg a while ago to talk about issues of race in Alaska. And they are doing a fabulous job of taking some of those 10,000-year-old processes for dialogue and deliberation and bringing them into a very contentious issue in a very elegant way along the lines of what you're saying. Because I think no discussion should go forward without us, without all of us.
So we are going to take just a short break, and when we come back, we're going to continue to talk about specific examples of actually how Alaskans are having a civil dialogue. You're listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm Shelley Wade.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Hometown Alaska, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Everyone, welcome back. You are listening to Hometown Alaska. I am your host, Shelley Wade, and today we are talking about engaging in civil discourse, whether you're in Anchorage or an Alaskan. Is it really possible for us to have good, positive conversations about really tough Alaska issues? So when we left, we were talking a little bit about one of the specific examples, and that sounds like First Alaskans is doing some great dialogue around race.
And having, so Libby, did you say they are having like conversations about that or?
They have been working with younger generation leaders all around the state to have these conversations in juvenile justice places, in schools, in conferences on reproductive rights, all over the state in different settings. Mm-hmm. They've been holding these conversations, including one on KSKA.
So that sounds like a really great example. And I wonder, Steve or Nils, if either of you have other examples of just really the best or how that kind of civil dialogue is happening in Alaska right now or has happened and other good examples of how those conversations are positively happening. Nils?
Well, I think the UAA debate team is a great example. I'll let Steve talk about that. But, you know, I don't think the Institute does it great, but we do provide a number of fora for active participation in civic dialogue and encourage civility in that space. Both at the Alaska Dialogue up in Talkeetna every year, we've tried to tackle difficult issues and provide a space for Alaska community leaders to come up with creative solutions to policy issues. We've done the same now for 5 years for emerging leaders every May, and we'll be in Kodiak this spring. So getting 21 to 40 year olds together to talk about their future and being able to meaningfully contribute to that future. I think that there are, I don't know if you're familiar with Beyond Borders, but Christian Muntin does an excellent job of facilitation and conflict mediation. And I think is, you know, a very thoughtful a young man that is able to encourage and guide civil discourse. I think, you know, when it comes to, for us at the Institute, when it comes to Arctic issues, you actually see a lot of civility in that conversation and formal, in formal spheres too. And because you've got national, international, state, local actors together through something like an Arctic Council, or you know, the Northern Waters Task Force, you're really seeing a movement towards inclusion and consultation that at a level that I don't think we've really seen before. And I think, you know, the Arctic, and when they talk about it as a model of cooperation, I think it could be a model of civil discourse.
And what are, so it sounded like you said the inclusion piece is one of the key elements that's really allowing that to happen. Are there other things that are allowing that kind of conversation to happen? Is it the topic, or what is it that's bringing people to a place where they can actually have a civil discourse?
I think it's necessity. I think that maybe I'm naive in this, but I have the sense that we've had 50 years of very hard conversations, often ignored conversations, that there's a sense of urgency at this point that we have to get it right. And whether you're talking about getting your oil taxes right or your resource governance issues or mining, there's a sense that there's maybe a 5-10 year time span to figure things out. And the Arctic is kind of a great example of that. I mean, the Arctic wasn't on the top 10 list 5 years ago, and today it's on people's top five. So it's really been amazing the attention that's being paid to Arctic issues and within Alaska. Just where we're at as a state in our development path, we've got to do something. And I think people recognize that.
So you mentioned the Alaska Dialogue and Lead North, which is sort of the 21 to 40, you said, age range. And then also you folks offer, it's the Conference of Young Alaskans. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, so we've we picked up the Conference of Young Alaskans from the university, who had done that for 2 years, 2006 and 2009. We had hosted it in 2012. 55 young Alaskans come together, modeled after the Constitutional Convention, and spend 4 days picking five issues and articulating a vision for the future for the next 50 years, and then defining goals and action items around that. And that's an actually more formal process than something like the Alaska Dialogue or Emerging Leaders Dialogue, where there's a structure for how they get from A to B, and a voting method. So it wouldn't be like dialogue or debate. It would be more of a deliberative style to form consensus and get a final product out of that. The tricky thing when you give young people a voice is that you might not agree with them. Steve, I'm sure you've never experienced
I've
this.
I've never had that happen.
But it's something that it's really important to the Institute that you do provide that opportunity, because it's not necessarily about us. It's not about our perspectives. It's about providing that space and that freedom to meaningfully contribute, to come up with your own ideas, to risk a little bit. And that's how you grow. So I think if you hold on to that kind of commitment, then you could do just about anything.
So I want to come back to something that you said earlier, Steve, about, you know, it feels like somehow, you know, there's an issue or a problem with civil discourse right now in that it's maybe somewhat diminished. And I'm not sure if I'm capturing your thoughts correctly here. But maybe, you know, if you could share with us in that spirit, are there examples for you of how it actually is happening in a positive way? And is that sort of through, you know, your relationship as director of the debate team, there's a mechanism there, but outside of that realm, that sphere, do you see that happening elsewhere in Alaska?
Well, I think that there are lots of opportunities for Alaskans to engage in that. I think that there are lots of groups that are particularly interested in that. Is there one example of where that engages really well? I guess not at the top of my head that presents itself as a real clear example, but I think that there are lots of efforts between groups like that Nils was talking about, efforts located around the universities and other nonprofits that are working in town to give people an opportunity to find those spaces in which to explore ideas and express their needs.
Mm-hmm. So maybe talk a little bit more about what's going on at the university and the debate team. So you have, I saw a couple of different things that are happening. There's the Alaska Ethics Bowl and the Cabin Fever debate. And then what kind of sparked my interest was middle school public debate competition. Mm. So I guess like Institute of the North, you guys are engaging some younger folks too. So can you talk a little bit about those different opportunities?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the priorities of the Siegel Debate Program is to engage in education, but beyond the competitive environment. And so part of our mandate is to field competitive teams that engage in competition with other universities from across the nation and around the world. But equally important to our success is to make sure that we're out in the community offering those same opportunities for people to learn the training and advocacy that we try to represent through competitive debating, as well as discuss issues that are important to us. So last year, one of the initiatives that we pursued was starting the middle school public debate program. At this point, it is developing into something that we eventually hope will include all middle schools in Anchorage, as well as invite middle schools from around the state. And we had our first championship tournament last April on UAA. We invited our three partner schools, Clark, Begich, and Mirror Lake Middle Schools. And we got a group of middle school students who had never debated before to come together at this tournament and discuss a variety of hot and controversial issues. And I think that's part of what I really enjoy about the competitive aspect of debating is it provides these sort of incentives for students to engage. In some ways, you kind of trick them into getting informed about current events, issues, and controversial policy issues of the day. We had at last April's championship tournament for this first middle school public debate program tournament that we had. We had issues relating to wolf control in Alaska. We had issues talking about whether or not we should open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And so we're picking issues for those middle school students to debate that have to do with things that are very close to them, very mm-hmm. material to their futures as well. So those sorts of issues are ways that we get those middle school students involved. Since last April, we've seen significant interest exploding across middle schools in this. Once they hear about it, they get very excited about it. So we now have another tournament planned. We had one in December at Clark Middle School. We have another one planned in February at Begich, and we're expecting at that one to have about twice the number of schools we had at our original tournament last April. So I think it's going pretty well.
So a question I think I have for both you, Steve, and Nils, then, is so you are engaging these young folks. Are you able to track, or have you gotten interested in tracking kind of the impact that's having? So, you know, after young folks, you know, get involved with Conference of Young Alaskans, which sounds so exciting because they walk away with, it sounds like, a tangible action plan of some sort. So there's that experience, and then this experience of being able to research, you know, topics that are important to adults in Alaska. Sure. What's kind of the long term? Do we know if there a longer term impact than that one experience? So, Nils, are you guys tracking some of the young folks that you interact with?
We're all Facebook friends.
You're all Facebook friends.
Does that count? So I think there's two levels of tracking. I think a lot of times what people are looking for is, did the actions that they identified come true? Or has there been some progress on the work that they did? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's almost a, well, it's not the right place to start. Because I think with any of these issues, they're iterative and they, you know, they're just small steps towards some grander scheme of getting something done or changing something or whatnot. So I try to encourage people not to look at the actions and to look at the relationships that developed. And through Facebook and through other, you know, social media and just other efforts, I think what we've seen is kind of a growing community of young individuals who care about Alaska, who are more engaged than they were, are taking on new issues and new jobs and going to school and coming back and wanting to be involved and volunteering in ways that are just amazing. And they rely on each other more than, you know, anything we could create. They've got their own kind of cohorts that have developed, and as kind of these peer mentorships develop, you see them push and pull against one another and, you know, work to get better at things. And I don't have numbers for you, but that's my, I mean, 5 years on, that's kind of my sense of where things have gone. And it's just really neat to see.
Mm-hmm. And how about, Steve, for the middle school program? I don't know. How long did you say you guys have been doing that?
We just started last April. Okay. So there's not been a lot of tracking yet.
Yeah.
But I will say this. It is my firm belief that the sooner you get students involved in these opportunities and the sooner you give them the skills that they need and the opportunities to pursue and develop those skills, the greater and more significant the change you're going to see. Part of what I love about the job that I do is the chance to get to see students develop, and primarily I work with college students, and so there are some significant transformations that occur there. And we have a lot of success stories where a lot of our students have gone on to positions. We've got students that are currently in the State Department. We've got students that are working in the West Wing. We've got students that have done a variety of different things. But while those success stories are kind of what people expect our students to do, there are also a lot of success stories for students who have gone on to successful careers in baking, but they're better people for it. They're more open-minded people. They're more engaged in the world around them. And I think regardless of what final outcomes you get, those relationships that you build and that willingness to engage the world around you in an open-minded, respectful, and tolerant way is incredibly valuable.
Yeah, so it's they're folks are learning a skill set to engage in civil discourse. So I wanted to come back to you, Libby, on the question again of kind of what are the best examples in Alaska or elsewhere? So if we want to open it up a little bit and we feel somewhat limited by Alaska, you know, other examples of where people, particularly leaders, are coming together and having civil discourse on really tough issues and ultimately making some good decisions. Are there things that come to mind for you as Alaska examples or elsewhere where, you know, there's a good lesson or two to be learned from that experience?
What's coming to mind is just the fact that there are innumerable of these kinds of projects popping up all over the U.S. I mean, it is widely recognized that we're at a low point in terms of how we're doing with our public dialogue. We have been at these low points before. People often think this is the worst it's ever been. It is not the worst it's ever been. As if you look into the history at all, people were gunning each other down in the Congress, you know, at various points in American history. So, you know, it's not the worst it's ever been, but it's not too great, as we all know. And so particularly after things like shootings of legislators and so forth, these things are popping up in many places. I'm most familiar with those in higher ed, right? That's where I've been putting my attention. And there are a lot of great things happening. We are part of a national initiative that came out of the Ford Foundation 6-7 years ago, where they issued a proposal or took proposals from universities all across the nation for difficult dialogues projects on their campuses. And they're all very interesting and all very different. Ours has involved training faculty to have higher skill and confidence levels to proactively introduce controversial topics into the classroom and have it go well. We did a book called Start Talking that's free and online for anybody who wants to look at it. We're working on a book called Stop Talking, which is about Indigenous ways of working with difficult dialogues and teaching and learning. We have a Books of the Year program at APU and UAA to do with looking at controversial issues through texts. I've gone to South Africa to work with universities there and across the nation. So there's a lot of these kinds of projects going on. Most of the ones I'm aware of, and most of them, many appropriately, are coming out of universities, you know, as places where we ought to be really training our young people to become citizens who can support a democracy by engaging in civil discourse. I can't tell you that I'm aware of any really high-profile ones with our leaders where it's working that well. I wish that I could, but none are coming to mind.
I've got one that I'm optimistic about.
Oh, great. Okay.
And that is our discussion on immigration reform. I think that the recent announcement by the bipartisan, there's a group of eight senators that announced, four Democrats and four Republicans, that announced an initiative that they're going to pursue for immigration reform. And I think that that's one to watch. I'm not saying that it's going to be successful, but it's one to watch. And I think it's particularly interesting because if you look in our history, quite often unemployment rates and economic decline are paralleled by a rise in xenophobia. And immigrants are typically the first group that gets villainized whenever we have economic crises. And so I think it's really fascinating that we're now engaging in what looks to be a potentially productive bipartisan discussion about how we address the problem of undocumented aliens living in the United States that doesn't immediately default to name-calling and accusations and other sorts of jingoistic and nationalistic rhetorical tricks. So I'm optimistic about that one. I'm looking forward to seeing how that one plays out.
And let me just say that that was nudged into being by the public. There was a very clear impetus behind this, and that was because one party suffered greatly in the last election because it wasn't necessarily hearing a lot of the voices that are out there, and now they're responding, which is wonderful. But it really highlights the role of the public, that we can put pressure on our leaders to come together on issues of importance in ways that are more productive.
So while we're on this topic of just, you know, very specific strategies or forums, are there other things outside of what you're doing, Nils, for example, at the Institute of the North, or what you're doing, Steve, with the debate team, or Libby with the difficult dialogues, other things that you think that we should be doing as Anchorage residents, for example, to engage in more civil dialogue? So is it forums? Is it Facebook? You know, what is it, a combination of those things? Libby, do you have a specific thought on that?
Well, it's a small, doable thought. It's something everybody can do, and that is conversations with people with whom you don't agree. I was recently in Maine, and I was hanging out waiting for a boat to come, and the fellow next to me and I, it was before the last election, and I said, so what do you think of, you know, who are you going to vote for? And he was going to vote for somebody not who I was going to vote for. And I said, really, how interesting. Tell me more about that. And he did at great length. And I questioned and questioned and questioned him, and this goes back to what Bill Hall called in to say about listening, that you can, you know, listening is more important pretty much than anything else in this game. And I just kept asking him genuinely, why did he feel that way? And to tell me more about that. What were his deeper concerns? And what was his concern if the other party got elected and so forth? And as we went through the process, he would heave up these concerns. And I would say, I agree with you on that. And he'd heave up the next one, and I'd say, you know, I'm with you on that. He was concerned about the debt. He was concerned about people, you know, spending down their children's future capital. He was concerned about people who don't pay their taxes. He's concerned about a whole host of things, which also concern me. Now, as it happens, we both thought that there was a different solution, a better candidate to address those. But by the end, it was really obvious that we shared a huge middle ground. OK, and that is also true for Pebble Mine. It is also true when you go into abortion. It's also true when you go into many, many things, that if we can genuinely listen to the concerns of somebody different than we are. I've done this at rallies where I am visibly on one side and there are people heckling on the other side. And I will go and say, tell me where you're at with this and why do you feel that way? And I can tell you that at one point I did that in a particular rally 4 or 5 years later when they were asked to come together to bring together people from both sides who they wanted to facilitate. They actually cited me by name. We had spent maybe 5 minutes together. Mm-hmm. And the point that I got from that was nobody's talking to them with respect. Right? That was so huge to me. So everybody can do that. You can train yourself to connect with that person that you wouldn't usually, and then to listen to what they have to say.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Shelley Wade, and today we are talking about engaging in civil discourse, whether you're in Anchorage, an Alaska resident, listening from afar. How do we talk about difficult issues and have civil dialogue about those difficult issues? So please give us a call. There's still time. In Anchorage, you can call us at 550-8433. Outside of Anchorage at 1-888-353-5752. So Steve, when Libby was saying, you know, just talk to folks that maybe have different opinions, and there's you were doing an enthusiastic nod. So anything that you want to add to that?
Well, I think I commend Libby on her willingness to engage that. I think that takes a certain degree of bravery and open-mindedness that I wish others would demonstrate as well. But even prior to that, if you can't bring yourself to engage others on questions that are controversial and on which you have strong convictions, I would say just do half the step, which is just to go out and engage others. There's a book that was written a few years ago called Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam. And one of the things that he explores is how we are withdrawing from civic life. And there are all sorts of civic institutions that are deteriorating. We see whether it's commercial groups or it's religious groups or public service groups, but all of those things that used to be the institutions in which we invested and built relationships because of those investments, membership and activity in those institutions is declining. And I think what happens is you don't engage with people who are different from you, and it's very easy when you stop engaging, when you disengage from the community around you, it's really easy to become paranoid and distrustful and suspicious of others. And so I think that just basic human contact is so critically important to build that civic engagement in order to engage in civil dialogue, to recognize that even though a person might be different from you, they're not necessarily wrong, they're not necessarily bad, and they're not necessarily born of evil motivation. So I would say if you can't get out there and talk to people about things about which you might disagree, just get out there and talk to people, right? Don't insulate yourself from the rest of the world. And I think that goes to the trust that we have for each other. One of the things that came across in that Bowling Alone book that I referenced earlier was this longitudinal discussion of the deterioration of what Putnam calls generalized trust. So in the 1960s, when you would ask people, do you generally trust the people around you? It was somewhere around 60% of people registered in this public polling that they did. By 1970, it was down to 50%. By 1990, it was down to 40%. And by 2006, it was down to 32%. So when you ask people just generally, without identifying a particular person or context, do you trust the people around you? In 2006, we're giving answers like only 32% would be willing to say that they trust the people around them. Some of that has to be born from the isolation that we're experiencing because of things like social media. And I don't want to lay everything at the feet of the internet, but that's quite often a good whipping horse to look to. But I think that isolation contributes to that distrust and that suspicion that we share.
And can I leap in on that? And I know most of you probably have heard of this, but if you haven't, it's so important. The fact that on things like Facebook or even just the internet at large, my understanding is that the search engines begin to tailor the links that they send you to what you have already been visiting, so that we are increasingly, the TED talk that was given on this, somebody put in the word Egypt in a search engine in his liberal friend and his conservative friend, and they got utterly and totally different links. And one of them reflected the sort of Arab Spring activities. The other didn't even show it. It showed travel and tourism links, okay? And so the fact that people feel like they're operating in different worlds with different facts is not imaginary at this point. People actually think that what they see on the internet is factual or is neutral often. And that is not what's happening. And we have to be very aware of that, because we can walk into the same room with totally different realities. And that's dangerous.
Right.
Can I promote one more book?
Please do.
Make a recommendation, another book. Farhad Menju, a few years ago, wrote a book called True Enough that explores this in detail. It's a fantastic book that gets into the psychological and the economic and the technological reasons why we are increasingly living in our own realities rather than a shared reality. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Libby had mentioned is that, you know, we're now seeing these technologies kind of cater to that personalized, individualist, tailored approach to providing you with the information you need. And that feeds into a natural human inclination anyway, which is something called the selective exposure phenomenon, that we tend to tune into things that are interesting and confirming for us, and we tend to tune out things that challenge or disrupt our belief systems. So we naturally gravitate toward things that we believe in anyway. And then when you have technology that services us with information that is going to confirm what we believe, we get into these feedback cycles where we increasingly only get exposed to information that confirms what we believe, and therefore we only seek that out. And it's just, you can see where that goes.
Yeah, so I guess to maybe sum up some of those points, is the common theme or the message that I'm getting from you folks is that this, you know, face-to-face dialogue is extremely important. And that's why, Nils, I wanted to come back to you on just the experiences that you guys are providing and the forums that you're providing at Institute of the North. And so the Alaska Dialogue, that's been happening for how long now?
13 years.
Yeah. And so can you just share a little bit more about that opportunity, just in terms of like who's there? Because it sounds to me like it's really diverse perspectives, and you've got a lot of different representation from a lot of folks that you may not agree with necessarily.
It's not true. I wish it were more true. I think it's something the dialogue has suffered from, that over the years, it's something we've strived for, is a more diverse engagement at the dialogue. But and certainly you get different perspectives, but they're not as diverse as really we would hope for. And it's not as challenging as it should be. It's something that I think we've recognized for at least 5 years and have been working on, but I think there's work to be done, and I think that you'll see that evolution continue to happen as we shift places and people and all that. And the people who were part of the dialogue 10 years ago are not the people who are part of the dialogue today, mostly because, well, I'm not gonna talk about that. I did want to, I guess, comment on the Facebook thing, that civil-civic dialogue is not going to happen on Facebook. It does happen on Facebook, but the training that you need for this isn't, and that's the social media sphere is not where that's going to occur. It is in the personal space.
And I'd like to leap in on that as well, because I think that the touchier the dialogue, the more structured the dialogue needs to be. You really have to honor that, and facilitation is everything, and face-to-face is really critical there. And I know that Bill Hall's group, the Let's Talk Alaska and Anchorage, they're working on sort of trying to help develop facilitators and new forums. So people are definitely working on it as well, First Alaskans and so on.
And I think that, you know, so we've seen in the Arctic, I mean, in terms of processes, things that we should be replicating, I think, here in the state. And a lot of those are government-driven. And whether it's in Norway, when they decide on oil and gas issues, it's a tripartite kind of coalition of industry, government, and labor. And they've put in place a process where, you know, projects that come up get vetted and evaluated and decided upon within, you know, 6 weeks to 3 months. You would never see that in Alaska. Same thing in Yukon Territory as part of devolution. You see this across the Arctic, and a lot to learn from here in Alaska.
So we have talked about a lot of different ideas today, and thank you so much to my guest, Steve Johnson, the Associate Professor and Director of Debate at UAA, Libby Roderick, Associate Director of the UAA Center for Advancing Faculty Excellence, and she's also the lead for the Difficult Dialogues piece that we talked about today, and then Nils Andreessen, Executive Director for Institute of the North. You've been listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm your host, Shelley Wade.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.